This is Eleanor Swin, continuing the interview with Plato Malazimov in San Francisco on May 5th, 1988. Yesterday we had ended really with Carlin, I think, in Gold Quarry, hadn't we? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And now you wanted to talk about pressures that were on you to...
No, before that, I'd like to cover two foreign ventures that we went into that did not result in a continued investment or a new venture for us. But they were illustrative of the kind of far-flung interest in exploration and new ventures that I had at that time.
What was this time? Let's get the date for the period for sure.
Well, it continued right through. I mean, I've already covered in mm-hmm. what I have written up my first years and Newmonth, which really dates from about, I mean, my first presidency years, which really covers from about 54, when I assumed presidency, until early 60s.
Okay.
And as I said before, it appeared to show almost furious activity in acquiring something and the growth of the company. But this growth persisted, and it can be roughly classified that from the early 60s right on into 70s, this activity of acquisition continued in various areas, so that this particular one in that I'm going to start with, which is a diamond venture or diamond exploration in Lesotho, in South Africa, was begun actually in 1971.
It seems to me that in a way we have neglected to put some historical background on some of these things, and I did want to be a little more assiduous in that, I guess, as we continue the interview. For example, we have not mentioned CPEC or OPEC or any of those background events and developments which affected your work also. Now, of course, diamonds, I know nothing about changes in the diamond world, but...
actually, the CPEC and the CPEC was actually very ineffective. I mean, they met many times and resolved to do things and never did it. So their influence on mineral industry, and I watched all the actions they took, recommendations, and so on, but they really did not influence the flow of capital or policies of the companies that did what they did, or even the policies of the governments. They're essentially a government body. Insofar as OPEC is concerned, our involvement in oil was not a major one.
No, but
it's just comparatively a small one, and the only time that really it had an impact is when they drove the price of oil up from the $3.50 level to nearly $40 level, which of course affected the domestic prices as well, although the domestic prices never went up that high. But it affected the profits of our Newmont Oil Company. But there was nothing in Newmont actions or its policies that were specifically related to OPEC, where we did something because of the actions of OPEC. So that is why I have not mentioned it, because actually there has been little influence.
Except that the whole worldwide economic picture.
Oh, yes. Of course, I watched that very carefully, and I think I understand the drives behind the actions and what happened and how it affected economics, not only of the United States, but of the world as a whole. And I ascribe depression that the whole world suffered after 1974, essentially, to OPEC action. Mm-hmm. I think that some economists disagree on this, but I watched this with great interest and detail because it did affect the world picture, but did not affect directly Newmont actions.
No. Okay. We also haven't mentioned, well, we can bring this in later, but labor situations have not.
Yes.
Either, and we should touch
well,
on
I'm going to bring that up in my summary of at the end.
All right.
Certain observations on the total industry.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, excuse me for interrupting, but we'll go back to
diamonds being an important product of production from South Africa and our involvement in South Africa for many years. Were always of considerable interest to us. Actually, O'Keefe had some diamond deposits here and there, and at one time a diamond indication was discovered by us, and Banghart, who was then the president of O'Keefe, and this was in the late 40s, decided that because diamonds were always a politically tinged problem for the government, and they have special regulations insofar as the taxes are concerned, and
this is
so
South
on
Africa.
In South Africa, so that when the discovery was made on O'Keefe ground, he decided not to get involved in this rather sensitive area of and invited actually others to take on the exploitation of this, and the others happened to be somewhat affiliated with the political representative or MP from the O'Keefe district. So he sort of pushed the whole thing into that political arena, retaining some royalty. It turned out to be a profitable, a rather small venture, and O'Keefe received small royalties on it, but never of great moment. We did get involved directly in diamond exploration offshore. For a time, a Texan came in with the idea that offshore diamonds could be recovered from the west coast of South Africa in general areas where onshore diamond operations were being conducted, especially near the mouth of the Orange River, where it was a huge operation run by De Beers, and a very successful one. Well, he actually built a special dredge for recovering diamonds, and at least from the press releases that he gave out, it was a very successful operation. At any rate, he operated for about 2 or 3 years, and Harry Oppenheimer became intrigued with this idea, and De Beers did know that diamonds did occur there, and there was some evidence that he was recovering diamonds, and he became convinced without really having real information, because this Texan would not reveal all the information to him, that this was a real operation, and he bought him out for a very good sum. I forget what it is, but
Harry Oppenheimer bought out the Texan.
Well, De Beers did.
Oppenheimer was the head of De Beers.
Yes.
Right.
So they took over this dredge and continued the operations, but found that the operation was not successful and had to shut it down within 2 or 3 years. I was interested in this and the technology of this and why it was that they failed at this. And at least at that time, it seemed that perhaps their ability to maneuver the dredge on paths that would be consistently cover the whole diamond area, those means were not available. So the paths that the dredge took were rather erratic. So they missed some areas and took other areas. And the sampling, which was done fairly well and checked by De Beers later on, indicated a continuous or somewhat variable concentration of diamonds here and there, and apparently the rich areas were somehow missed and dredge operated the low areas at any rate.
Now, excuse me, this is a dredge that's operating in the ocean.
And it was very difficult.
Waves
and all that moved it around and all that kind of thing. So anyway...
Is this done? I've only heard of dredges.
Well,
in
I'll continue. I'll continue all this. Right. So... after the shutdown of this operation, some few years later, one of the men, De Beers' men, that was there, an engineer, and a very competent technical man, decided to repeat that effort, knowing the problems that they had in a big De Beers dredge, and he got financed by some a fishing syndicate, and decided to use, actually, and modified one of the fishing boats for this purpose. A much more smaller enterprise, and modest in size, and modest in total capital required. Well, we heard about this and followed it for a while, and it seemed to us that, and I actually visited the dredge on one of my trips, and had a very exhaustive explanation by this engineer what he did and in what way it was different from the Anglo-American. It seemed to me that some of the problems that I suspected that De Beers had, he was overcoming them. And by this time, also a development has was made in the ability to locate a floating vessel in the ocean and to properly move it around by having a fixed point of reference, largely a special electronic way of locating where the dredge was with respect to certain areas, trigonometric manipulation, but added with computer technology and that kind of thing. And it was amazing, he pointed out to me, how he could, regardless of the tides and storms and winds, he could keep that dredge located and then in the same spot and move it along given path. Well, I thought that that might solve the problem that I saw with the others. So we entered into that venture put up, I think, something like $200,000 for possible interest in the venture. Again, the exploration of the ocean bottom was, I think, fairly reliable and showed diamond concentrations of economical quantity. However, the dredge was not recovering, but we thought it should be recovering. And at the time, because I was busy, I sent Oscar F. Tangle to look at the dredge, essentially not because he was an expert in diamonds or anything, but he was an engineer was an amazing ability for meticulous and careful analysis, and one who would not be influenced by the opinions of others, and he relied entirely on his engineering analysis of this of whatever he was doing.
Was he working for Newmont?
He was by that time in Newmont. Yes, I hired him. So he went out there, and he spent about 2 weeks on the dredge, and ended up by recommending that we drop our venture and don't continue with it. And he didn't go into the causes of what the problems were, but it was obvious that they were not doing what they expected to do. That was our last diamond venture for a time. The next one was something that we heard of in Lesotho. Lesotho is a small state in southern Africa, which is independent, and it's a black state. We heard rumors of a very large pipe, diamond pipe, of kimberlite and typical mineralogical assemblage that the big pipes in South Africa were characteristic of, that contained diamonds. And the diamonds had been known there and had been worked from time to time by natives in small scale. The property rights to that were obtained by Lonro, L-O-N-R-H-O, mining company, which was a smallish mining company, but very venturesome, under the direction of rather flamboyant character by name, who was generally known as Tiny Rowland, R-O-W-L-A-N-D. He was a true entrepreneurial type, and he operated essentially within the black Africa in areas where other larger companies try to really avoid it because of political uncertainties, but somehow he made friends with the ruling parties and was able to make deals and so forth. Very venturesome. At any rate, he gained control of this pipe, didn't have too much money, and I approached him and to see whether he would be willing to sell out. He'd already done some work on this, which was rather promising. And
excuse me, how do you approach somebody like this?
Well, I heard.
Call them on the phone. You write them a letter.
Yeah, well, I heard about him, and first of all, we started negotiating with his people.
How?
In South Africa, somebody, my representatives did that, but later on, it was, and we offered a joint venture with him. Wasn't very satisfactory for a while, and later on I decided to buy him out completely, and to do that I had to go to London and meet him, and we struck a deal.
London.
Yeah.
No, I'm interested just in specifically, do you do this sort of thing at the country club or at one of your offices or at
no,
a
you
intermediary?
Learn who the owners are, their representatives. You contact the representatives and you want to talk about the possibility of our entering the venture. They say, well, we'll check with our boss, and they check with the boss and says yes, and then start negotiations, and usually, and especially, and there we go.
I was wondering, for example, do you avoid putting anything in writing? Do you do it by phone rather than by letter in the initial stages?
Well, no, you sit down and have conferences, and you then the next step is usually a letter of intent.
Yes.
And you work on that and agree on the terms of that, and once you've worked that out, then the contract or agreement is made,
but
which is
the
by the lawyers.
The very first touchy contact.
Well, yeah, sometimes it's done with the principal, sometimes with subordinates.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I made one deal with Harry Appenheim directly, and something in his office where in about 3 minutes we agreed on principal terms. It took about 3 months to carry this out, mm-hmm. and to get an agreement signed up. But the basic principles of the agreement were those that he and I agreed on, and he stuck to it despite the fact that his subordinates didn't like the deal.
So in Tiny Roland's case, you went to London.
I went to see him, and we made finally a complicated deal in which over the time, and he put a time limit on this, we had to pay him 500,000 rand for his interest. We invited U.S. Steel, who was then also exploring in South Africa, to become partner of this, and they consented. So we had a 50% and they had 50% interest in this. The geological study, which was done even before we made the deal, indicated that indeed there was a very large pipe, probably the even bigger pipe than the famous Premier mine in South Africa, and there were diamonds recovered from it for many years by natives. It was the record of how much they recovered and what the concentration was not very reliable, and it was suspected that there was a lot of stealing of diamonds and smuggling away from this, so that they were not recorded officially. So it really was quite unknown. But at any rate, they worked in a certain area, but it looked like there's a possibility existed over the entire pipe, but the rest of the pipe was covered with detritus, and you couldn't actually take samples right from the surface. So it required, what we did then was do some geophysical work in order to outline the limits of the pipe, which was relatively easy and reliable, and then did the drilling, and unfortunately with diamonds, because the number of diamonds that are of commercial quantity is so small that you have to have enormous samples in order to get a few diamonds that become commercial. So you actually have to have a recovery plant, in effect, not just take samples, assay it someplace, but you have a plant right there that would wash these diamonds and you recover them, and that's the way you assess the content of the ground.
Now you're looking mainly for industrial diamonds.
No. This place was known for having some gem diamonds as well. Mm-hmm. At any rate, we continued this exploration for about a year and a half, and we had to pay the $500,000 without that time. So there was a cost of an acquisition that was not really related to our success in finding diamonds. And in the end, we found that indeed there were diamonds there, but not commercial quantity. Here and there, there were commercial pockets like that, but not sufficient to mount a large venture. So we abandoned this venture. The other foreign venture that we went to, also with U.S. Steel, was in Irian Barat. IRIANBARAT, which is a section of Indonesia covering a number of islands. We were looking for nickel, and it was known that these islands had laterite nickel deposits, but they were never assessed. The joint venture was organized to explore these laterite deposits, in which Newmont had 15%, U.S. Steel 43%, Sherrod Gordon 10%, and two Dutch companies 32%. Our entrance into this venture was to bring in a newly devised process for treating laterites that Sherrod Gordon had experimented with, and were willing to pilot in their plant in, at the Fort Saskatchewan to point up that it, it was a viable process. The we tested nickel deposits in two different islands. The first, and originally established a total reserve of some 309 million tons of 1.43% nickel, of which 164 million tons of 1.48% nickel were then thought to be at Gag Island, G-A-G Island.
Is this high grade? Low grade, I don't know much about nickel.
This is sort of medium grade, but approaching a commercial grade laterite. Later on, further exploration led us to decide that the Gag Island was the one that had the better deposit, and that we'd concentrate on that. And further drilling, completed in 1975, indicated a total tonnage of 262 million tons of 1.52% copper. And certain subsequent work indicated that part of this could be mined at even a higher degree, perhaps approaching 2%. The original estimate for the plant and opening up the mine required the new port facility was $550 million, by which was made in 1972. By 1973, a new estimate was made, and the new estimate was approaching $1 billion. And however, we persisted with this until 1975. We established this deposit, and the last assessment was, well, what would we do if we went after this high grade first? One of the requirements of the Sherrod Gordon process was the use of fuel, and oil was the fuel most readily available, but because Indonesia produces oil. Of course, in those early 70s, it was very cheap. The oil in that part of the country could be had for something like $3.50, $4 a barrel. In 74, the OPEC, of course, started raising the price, and by 1975, the price of oil rose, and to the point where it was questionable whether the process was going to be economic. And we spent a lot of effort in, first of all, in negotiating an agreement with the Indonesians to give the foreign investors the right to export money and to that would be earned from this venture. And this was always a problem with these with the nations. They wanted to keep all the money and have control of what money was sent out. But we finally, and I think largely through my efforts, I absolutely was adamant in saying that we had to have this provision or we wouldn't want to go ahead with the venture. To a to arrive at a satisfactory agreement took us almost 2 years.
Right.
Well, which we did finally, and the people that were negotiating were Ed Fontaine and Jack Thompson, but I was masterminding that negotiation.
And they were doing this in Indonesia.
I wasn't. I was in the United States, but they had to go to Indonesia, to Jakarta, in making these, to make these this agreement. And we, despite the fact that we only had 15%, we really were the leaders in the negotiations at that time. The U.S. Steel representative was a vice president and a geologist by the name of Bob L'Espérance, L'Espérance, very nice fellow, good geologist, but not a very good businessman. And I think that the reason he allowed Newmont to dominate the negotiation process is because he didn't have that experience himself. At any rate, we had a very good relationship with U.S. Steel, and despite our small percentage, they did listen to us and allowed us to really be leaders in this negotiation, although they were always present there. Also, the question of whether the new a new estimate was should be made or not was mostly in our hands because of Sherrod Gordon's process, and the technology came from them, and their representatives were the technical experts on in the metallurgical treatment of this, and they at one time they went through a pilot plant testing of several thousand, tens of thousands of tons of ore that was brought over from Indonesia to Canada. And they were assessed that, and they had to come up with estimates of costs and so on. This was a very large venture. We established a special office in San Francisco, and we're going to, and in the estimates of the cost of the venture, we used Bechtel Corporation, which was in San Francisco. And so that this was sort of the nerve center for this whole venture.
Did Bechtel do your construction for you?
No, they did the estimates. It never got to the construction stage.
Oh, all right.
Well, when finally these figures started coming out that this was going to cost close to $1 billion, and I became, first of all, Sherrod Gordon became disillusioned, and they dropped their interest. They withdrew from the whole venture.
But now Sherrod Gordon is a subsidiary of
Newmont. No, it was then 38% affiliate of Newmont.
All right.
So they had a right for individual action. Well, when they dropped out because they lost interest in it economically, of course, it made us think, well, should we continue or not? And we reassessed it for our from our point of view. We kept up with it for another year and a half, and developed this new idea of high grading the deposit. But even with that, the final estimate indicated that in order to make this a viable venture, we had to have a price of nickel that would be eventually about $5 a pound. At the time, it was only 70 cents a pound. And we estimated what the effect of the inflation would be, the effect of the increase in the price of oil that affected the cost and so on. So actual cost of production had we mounted it back in the late 70s was escalated. So originally we had to have at least $2 and then escalate to $3 and then and on up. At this point, and my associates, Jack Thompson and Ed Fontaine, thought that this was a reasonable estimate for the nickel prices to go up this high, because at that time nickel was a desirable metal and the prices were moving upwards. And they were for recommending this to our board to proceed with the construction and putting the whole thing into production. In reading the feasibility report, which was actually written up by Bob Ramsey, I found this section on forecasting prices to be questioned. Just about that time, a number of other ventures started up, one in Guatemala, another in other area of Indonesia, and one in Dominican Republic, all laterite ventures. And they were, some of them were already producing nickel and some of them were about to produce nickel, but it was quite clear to me at that time that the dominance that international nickel had in the nickel market, which in effect held the umbrella, price umbrella over the rest of the industry, and they really moved the price and kept the price, protected the price from fluctuating. It was a very constant increase in price patterns. I was afraid that this dominance of international nickel so far in the marketplace was about to be lost. It wasn't lost at the time. My hunch was it would be lost because of these new productions that would come about. And I could see from the scale of these operations that there would probably, this would probably result in the excess nickel being produced. And just from standpoint of supply and demand, I didn't think that international nickel could maintain the price, and that the chance for reduction in price was quite high, and I didn't think it was realistic to consider that the prices would escalate $2 to $3 or $4 or $5. I made that known to my associates. They didn't agree with it, but we had long discussions of this back and forth and many arguments, economic and the role of international nickel and what happened to these deposits, so on. At any rate, I killed the feasibility report and did not, and insisted we do not make a recommendation to our board to proceed with this, which was great disappointment to Jack Thompson and Ed Fontaine, in whose hands I left this whole venture, and actually I wasn't even represented on the new board that was created for running this. I let them represent Newmont, but they reported to me regularly. So they saw it as their venture, and also and I killed their venture for them, so they were very greatly disappointed. Well, it turned out that I was absolutely right. The price of nickel actually from that time did move up to nearly $2 and got up to $2.10, but was hovered in that area and sometimes dropped as low as $1.60, $1.70. And kept at that level, that fluctuating level, for the next 12 years. Yeah. And only this year did it all of a sudden blossom forth, and has gotten up to about $7 or $8 mm-hmm. recently in Europe. So this venture would have been a disaster had been gone into it. So I think that I saved the new month countless headaches and a lot of money in not proceeding with it. And of course, the capital cost was also so high that it was even more risky.
Has anyone else continued with it?
No, for a time, U.S. Steel thought that they would go ahead by themselves. But and I had contact with other executives of U.S. Steel who wanted to know why my opinion was to withdraw from this and all this. And they finally decided not to go ahead. I think essentially because of my arguments that this was not going to be economic. And later on, we tried to sell the venture. We had difficulty in selling our interest. And I think it remains unsold, so far as I know. At any rate, the money that we put into it is lost.
mm. But if the price is high now, someone might...
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to last. I think it's a blip.
Into it.
I doubt it, because it, you know, it requires such an enormous investment. Today, probably, the investment would be $1.5 billion or $2 billion. Everybody mm-hmm. would question whether they want to put that much more money into something. First of all, it's a new technology, and it's a high-cost technology. And most of the laterite ventures, except those of the French company Nickel in New Caledonia, have not succeeded. Actually, have failed to be profitable.
Now you had a small nickel venture in Baja California at one time.
No, that was just a metallurgical attempt to try to smelt the laterite ventures in a reverberatory furnace, and the laterite came from Oregon, actually.
Oh.
And we shipped it there, and this was just in the pilot plant venture, which was a failure. We found we could not smelt it in reverberatories because the reverberatories could not maintain high enough temperature to keep the slag sufficiently fluid. So it was a sort of metallurgical experiment.
So I presume that Thompson and Fontaine forgave you in time.
Yeah, I think so. We have a good relationship later on, despite this. Well, in the middle 70s, partly, I think, because of the independence movement that started in 1960 in South Africa, and expropriation of large and viable and successful enterprises by the French, by the Belgians, by the English, were expropriated or partly nationalized in what was then Northern Rhodesia and Belgian Congo. The board began to look upon foreign investments with a jaundiced eye.
Now, Were you also getting pressure from stockholders?
No.
Or was that later?
No, we weren't. Well, I was watching this process also, of course, and was quite aware of greater and greater risks of investment abroad, and my policy was not to invest in any areas that I thought politically unstable. Last such venture, which turned out to be a failure, was in Algeria, of course, when Algeria went independent. So I avoided, like the plague, East Africa altogether and West Africa. And we turned down almost any and all proposals that came from that part of the country. I had the same skeptical opinion of the stability and fair treatment insofar as the Near East was concerned. So while we've had some proposals to go into Saudi Arabia and Iran and so on, I declined to do anything about them. So about the only area which we considered as being a stable one and one where we could operate in the African continent was the Republic of South Africa. That led to our development of Palabora, which was a magnificent venture in the mid-60s. Well, by 1970, feeling arose, especially on the part of André Meyer, that we should avoid making any more investments abroad. And he was especially apprehensive about South Africa, Republic of South Africa. I think it's understandable why. As a matter of fact, he expressed himself, it gave me the clue why. He was Jewish, and of course, some of the actions and policies that the South African government employed reminded him of Hitler regime, and that was something that he was particularly, as a Jew, was particularly sensitive to, and he felt this was an area that could explode any time and could be unfair to, as a result, to private investment, and we shouldn't make any further moves in private investment. Although he never got to the point of saying, let's get rid of South African investments because they were profitable. Well, I agreed with that in general. I felt somewhat reluctant to abandon South Africa altogether because there were some further opportunities, but every time I talked about something, I got sort of the cold shoulder from, first of all, from André Meyer and then from some of the other directors. So it was quite evident the general mood of the board was to move away from these disturbed areas and from South Africa and to emphasize North Africa in our investments, which I made, in effect, our policy from there on.
Did you ever have a written statement of this policy?
No. No, it was entirely verbal and a matter of discussion. There was no great controversy about it. I set up my views quite honestly. I thought South Africa was safe. Several directors did not agree with me, and however, we already had excellent investments in South Africa, and I felt that there were opportunities also in North America, and we should exploit them. So over the...
I think
next.
I think there was a statement in one of your annual reports, however, about that time.
Yeah, that's right, as a policy.
Mm-hmm.
So I can, over the next roughly 10 years, we emphasized or went into new ventures, five different ventures, which cost us about $660 million, of which $165 million was Newmont investment, the rest was borrowed. These included expansion of Magma or San Manuel, the resumption of the Resurrection mine activity, exploration and also operations, the starting of Atlantic Cement Venture, the Similkameen mine, which we discovered ourselves, and the investment in later on the control and operations of the Grand Duke mine in British Columbia.
Similkameen was also in Canada.
Similkameen is in Canada. I think I might start with Magma, which is essentially the expansion of the San Manuel venture. San Manuel ore body was described in Ramsey's book as to the original origins, regarding the original origins of it, and I may repeat some of it. Actually, San Manuel did not belong to Magma, but some claims at San Manuel in Arizona were owned in part by some of the Magma employees, an assayer and another, I think, a geologist in the Magma's office had an interest in it, and some other, they had a group of investors of some five or six people. And during the war, they went to the government because they didn't have any money shortly after the war. No, during the war, that was. When there was a program by the federal government of, in which they set up a special agency that provided money for exploration of new deposits, and they utilized, they applied for money and got some money to drill this area prospect, which was known but not ever tested, and got some rather spectacular results. Low-grade ore, but very thick ore. They drilled only maybe three or four holes or five holes. Actually, Bureau of Mines drilled it for them, and they were the owners. At that time, we had John Gustafson. We hired him as a geologist, sort of roving geologist, the new ventures, and this was in Fred Searle's time before I became president. And he had been instructed to look at the Magma Superior mine and see what promise there was in that mine. And while he was working on that prospect, he heard in the office these fellows talk about the San Manuel prospect, so that aroused his interest, and he inquired more about it, found out
the ownership, got the results, and recommended to Newmont, or to Magma, rather, that this was a prospect that they should try to obtain.
And Magma was partly owned by Newmont, or was it?
22% owned by Newmont at that time, but essentially an independent company with independent board, which, however, was located in the Newmont offices. Well, one thing led to another. At any rate, Magma made a deal for it and got the control of the property, drilled it out, and it turned out to be a major ore body that they found. They,
so this is all in the middle 1940s.
Yes. And the, what they the drilling results indicated that there was something like 123 million tons of oxide ore, about 0.767% copper, and 339 million tons of sulfide ore of 0.788% copper underlying the oxide ore, for a total of nearly 462 million of 0.782% copper. When I joined Newmont in 1985, right after the 1945, right after the war, plans for doing something about this ore body were being discussed, and there was a division.
Excuse me. Had you had any connection with this in your work at OPA?
None at all.
No.
And the there was a division of opinion among the executives of Newmont. Fred Searles was, with his natural caution for spending too much money, was felt that this should be developed and produced on a small scale, not greater than 10,000 tons a day. And McNabb, who was then running Magma, felt that in order to make this viable, it was going to be an underground mine and relatively low grade, that the minimum tonnage should be 30,000 tons a day. Of course, made vast difference as to what the capital cost would be. Capital cost of the 30,000 tons was approached the $100 million, whereas 10,000 might have been done with $30 or $40,000, $30 or $40 million. I got involved in this altercation, and Fred, I was then Fred's assistant by this time. And Fred thought that, talked to me about it at length, and he actually even wrote letters to the board and wrote letters to the government that linking me with him, being of the opinion that should be produced at 10,000, which I did not hold. I actually sided with McNabb. I felt that this should be developed at a higher rate, otherwise it would be not would not be economic. At any rate, the story of the conflict is well expressed, well stated in Ramsey's book, and I will not repeat it. But there was a conflict, and lots of delays as a result of that conflict, because Fred Searles was at that time in post-war period for a time in the White House and still wielding a lot of influence, and knew a lot of people, and he nearly killed the financing of this project for a while. So that, in effect, the whole financing and the development of this was delayed by this lack of agreement as to how it will be done. But in the end, McNabb won out and secured the financing and proceeded with this venture. By and it was started at 30,000 tons a day. When I became president in 1954, it was the San Manuel was just about starting in starting to operate. In planning the operations, and I think this illustrates one of the questions that you have, the MAGMA engineers and directed by McNabb decided to make sort of a worldwide survey of all caving operations. This is going to be a caving mine. And they went to all the mines that were caving ore at that time, whether it be copper or other, to learn of the technology, the problems, the difficulties, costs, and so on. And they received remarkable cooperation from all these companies, even though the companies were not affiliated with Newmont, so that they learned a great deal, not having that experience and knowledge themselves.